This is Danny, Dave, and Moore.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Now, the opening drive.
Seahawks have themselves a new backup quarterback. Paxton Lynch, former first-round pick, guy from Memphis, who was, well, he was part of the draft class with Jared Goff and with Carson Wentz, and he spent last season out of football, but he's been signed by the Seattle Seahawks. This is one of the moves, one of the opportunities that you get as the Seahawks, where you get a chance to give a guy a rebound opportunity. And I think that this is a great value for the Seahawks, and I see absolutely no downside in signing a guy who was considered talented enough to have been a first-round pick, and you get him, give him a chance to start over.
Yeah, and he was the 26th pick in the draft that year, and I had forgotten about that because that was the Goff and Wentz year. And how did that go? Was it Goff, Wentz, or Wentz, Goff?
Went Goff, then Wentz.
Goff, Wentz, yeah. And I just remember asking a lot of different people and kind of polling, and a lot of people thought that Wentz. And, you know, look, who would you rather have?
Didn't you have inside information that year? You knew who was going to be number one?
No, I didn't. I just asked a lot of people around the NFL who would they take. And it was primarily, I mean, mostly Wentz. But, you know, it worked out for Goff. I think it's a great reason. Jared Goff going to the Rams and then Sean McVay coming in to coach him is a great advertisement for Paxton Lynch coming here. Because if you don't get with the right guy in the right system, you're not going to be very good. And I think that that really matters in the NFL. I don't think Jared Goff would be a good quarterback if he didn't have Sean McVay there. I don't think he was. He might find his way somewhere down the road, but for whatever reason, Paxton Lynch, it didn't work out with him. And we'll find more out about that from his agent, Lee Steinberg, who we're going to talk to later. But, you know, I think you got to be in the right situation. A lot of this, and it's the same thing with the draft, a lot of it is the timing and luck. It really is, you know, and I think about my own career, like at times where if I had not gotten hurt or if something hadn't happened or this thing or that thing or, you know, going into a good situation, I mean, it was a great situation for me going to Denver, and that was just more of a luck and timing type of thing. So, you know, I think for Paxton Lynch to come here and be able to learn under Russell Wilson and maybe he gets the right coach saying the right things to him, it could work. So I'm with you, Danny. I don't really see the downside. You got a first round draft choice from 3 years ago. Now, it hasn't worked out at all for him, but look at what Solari did to the offensive line in the running game this year. You know, and I'm not saying it's just him. It could be also that Schottenheimer was a big part of it, but you had, you know, you brought in Sweezy and Fluker, but how did Jermaine Ifedi get so much better? You know, how did they go from the number 23 running game to number one? It had to have been coaching. And so if he gets here and all of a sudden, you know, he's behind Russell Wilson, gets Russell's attitude. I mean, I can't think of a better guy to be behind and learn from. You know, look, it could work out.
No, I'm with you on that. It's a no-risk deal. If it doesn't work out, then you can just get rid of him like Denver did. But I don't think it's a given that Paxton Lynch is going to go into next season as the backup quarterback. I don't know how you guys feel about it, but just based on what you read about him from Denver, he lost his backup job to Chad Kelly this year. And Chad Kelly, the next time we heard about him, he was at somebody's house dressed up as a cowboy and getting hit with a vacuum tube. So, you know, I mean, I don't think that says too much for Paxton Lynch. And then he got released in favor of Kevin Hogan, who we saw playing at Stanford. And so I guess then he wasn't picked up the rest of the year. So how good can Paxton Lynch be? He doesn't have to be that great. But the Seahawks are in need of a backup quarterback. You know that Brett Hundley's a free agent and that Alex Magoo has already moved on to Jacksonville.
I agree with you that I don't think it's guaranteed that he's the backup. I think he's got to earn the job. What I like about this is that Seattle's using it as an opportunity to see if putting a talented guy in a new environment can jumpstart it. And I feel like this is the first time they've done this at quarterback, where they've taken a guy who's got a pretty good resume coming into the league, who really hasn't done anything in the league, and seemed like maybe he can bounce back. Because Brett Hundley, when they traded for Brett Hundley, and we'll still see, they still very well might re-sign Brett Hundley, and he might end up coming back here. But when they traded for him, they traded for a guy that, well, he'd played a significant amount at that point. He'd played a significant amount in Green Bay because Rodgers had been hurt the year before, and the Packers had seeing that, okay, he's not really up to snuff. He's not really, and I thought it was, he's a competent backup. He's going to be someone that can come in and you could figure, like, if all things go well, he might be able to win you every other game that's there. This is a different kind of player. Paxton Lynch is someone where they're like, we know there's talent in there, but he hasn't even shown the ability to stay on an NFL roster, but maybe we put him in this and you might end up having something. Quarterback is the only position in the NFL where guys, the value can appreciate. It's the only one. Everything else is like a new car.
When guys get older?
Yeah, the moment you draft them or the moment you sign them as a free agent, almost instantaneously, well, they're worth more than you're paying. They're not worth as much as you're paying for them. Quarterback's the only one where you could buy low and sell high.
Well, the other thing, it's going to be tough for Paxton Lynch. I mean, they traded a sixth rounder for Brett Hundley. Now, it was only a one-year deal, but you know, you would think that since they traded for that they think pretty highly of him. He's thrown for twice as many yards as in the same period of time, really, 2016 and 17 for Hundley. You know, Hundley's thrown for 1,850 yards, and for Lynch, it's 700, 800, something like that. So, you know, he's thrown four touchdowns, four interceptions. We don't know. Supposedly the knock on him, I just want to say this, that the knock on him was that he played lots of video games.
Yes.
They found out somehow. As long as it's Madden and not shooting zombies, I'm okay with it.
You'd prefer Madden video game playing as opposed to zombie shooting?
It's football related,
Danny. Oh, come on, though.
What do you think, that shooting zombies is going to help his deep ball?
Well, do you think that playing Madden is going to help the deep ball?
Well, football. At least he's calling plays.
I don't know. I think that actually I might prefer the zombie
shooting. He's managing the clock, Danny.
That's true.
You said that.
That's true.
Pot-smoking Madden players should,
at the very least,
manage
timeout. Actually, fair point. If he's played a ton of Madden, he'll be good at end-of-game situations. We can get him on a headset with Pete.
So, supposedly, the report is that, because they send guys home with computers.
Yes.
Right? And they were able to find out that he was playing lots of video games.
Supposedly, the media there tracked down what his gamer profile was.
Oh, the
media
did.
And was able to see when he was there.
Oh, I see.
We will try to get to the bottom of that. But right now, let's bring on Lee Steinberg. Lee Steinberg is a longtime NFL agent. Seriously, he's one of the guys that was seen as an inspiration for the movie Jerry Maguire. He's written a book called The Agent. He has represented quarterbacks such as Steve Young, and right now Paxton Lynch is his client. So, Lee, I guess we'll start by asking, what makes Seattle the best fit for Paxton Lynch right now?
Well, I think that the opportunity to learn behind Russell Wilson, we saw how that benefited Patrick Mahomes, for example, when he sat behind Alex Smith. But I think as a mentor, it's a particularly bright one, and in a sense, we're restarting Paxton's career. He went to Denver. He does two things extraordinarily well in addition to whatever else a quarterback does. And one is he throws moving outside the pocket, and at his height, it's sort of amazing to watch him scamper, and he throws on the run. The other thing he does is he has a great deep touch. And in Denver's offense, neither of those skills were highlighted. It just wasn't in their scheme. And so when we look at Seattle's offense, we think he fits much better. And it's a great organization. So, you know, having Pete Carroll and being in that circumstance, I think Paxton was a first rounder. We thought he'd be a franchise quarterback. I think he still will be one day, but this is a good place for him to be.
Well, you bring up a great point, Lee. I don't think there could be a better mentor for him in Russell Wilson. Tell us, what kind of a guy is he off the field?
He has a very funny sense of humor. He's very family-oriented, so I used to say that to represent his values, it's faith, family, friendship, and football. So he's very family-oriented. He's very spiritual. He's got a killer sense of humor, and I think people will enjoy him. And again, he didn't get much of a chance in Denver, because what would happen is they'd play him one game, and then he'd sit down for 10 games. They play him another game and he'd sit down for a while. And what you need as a quarterback is to get a rhythm and to keep seeing the field consistently enough over and over and over again so that it slows down. And that just happens with time. So he was not in an offense that particularly suited him. But I think they're getting someone who's got incredible potential. They'll love him as a person, and he'll be a sponge just trying to learn and then, if necessary, to take the reins for a game.
Lee, a couple of questions. First, when he was first drafted in Denver, did you think that was the right fit for him? And then, if so, when did that turn?
I thought it was a great organization for him because they had just won the Super Bowl. And at that particular time, they had a real system for success from the front office to John Elway. Since then, things have not gone so well there. And when we saw the offense, which had a lot of outs and short passes, it just didn't seem to fit him very well, and it didn't highlight what he could do best. In other words, he can throw a bomb, he can scamper around and throw off the run, but it, for whatever reason, you know, he appreciated his time there, but I think this will be better for him.
Lee, how has he handled being a first-round pick who hasn't quite worked out yet?
It's been frustrating for him, and I mean he's aware of the fact that of what his peers from that same year, you know, have done. You know, he's aware of the fact that Jared Goff and Carson Wentz were in his draft class, but. You know, he's got a real sense of inner stability. And what happened this year was he got cut, but we were sitting on a $1.3 million guaranteed contract. So it took the pressure off, even though he was dying to play, but it took the pressure off of just signing with someone where it wouldn't have gone well. And we got the opportunity to – Seattle was a team that – we thought had interest when he came out his draft year. And we've always sort of had our eye on that situation. And so when the opportunity came, we jumped at it.
What about the criticisms in Denver? I don't know if these are rumors or not, but saying Paxton Lynch had a poor work ethic, problems getting the playbook down, and playing video games too often.
Well, the last thing you mentioned seems to be a national pastime, right? And more players play Fortnite than anything. He's got a great work ethic. He's anxious to learn and participate. He's dedicating his life at this point to football. And I think they'll be very pleased with how tenacious he is and how committed he is to putting in the hours to learn the playbook. He had not played college football. He didn't get into the quarterback business till, you know, sort of late in high school, and he didn't have as many years starting as some people did. So it's not a surprise that, yeah, there was an adjustment process that was going to occur in terms of him picking things up, but you watch him. He'll when someone doesn't become elevated to the level they think he should play at, there are all sorts of theories, but I think you'll find him an enthusiastic hard worker.
We're talking to Lee Steinberg here. We're really grateful for him spending a little bit of time. Lee, you've been in this business for an awful long time. You've seen an awful lot of changes in the league. It seems this week specifically, there's a lot of talk about offense and that being the future of this league. You have the top four scoring teams in the league that are the final four teams. From your vantage point, a guy who's represented some of the very best Hall of Fame quarterbacks that are out there, do you think we are entering a new era of offense in the NFL?
I just wrote an article for Forbes on this topic, and which will run tomorrow, and I absolutely think that this is a different era of football. When I started, they would run the ball on first down, run the ball on second down, and then maybe throw it on third down. And the maxim was defense wins championships. Well, if you look this year, two of the most highlighted games were the Chiefs versus the Patriots, and I think that was 44-40. And the other most highly watched game was Rams versus Chiefs, and that was like 50-something to 50. And if you look at those four teams, it's not coincidental. It has never happened before that the four most offensive-oriented teams were teams that are in the final, because it's a pass-happy game. It's an offensive game. There are rules changes that hamper defensive backs. There's a new crop of quarterbacks that has been trained since youth, which didn't used to happen. They now go to 7-on-7 camps and passing camps, and college offenses have become more sophisticated. So these players have hit the league, and there's a whole new generation of quarterbacks playing at a high level that are younger. So if you look at the over-under for the games this weekend, they're like 56 and 55. So the Las Vegas is predicting these will be high-scoring games. Now, if you take the teams that had the best defense, fundamentally, one of them didn't make it, which was the one of them did not make it, and then every other one got knocked out in the playoffs. So that has to speak to something. I mean, fans love it. It's very exciting, but it's such a difference from if you went back 20 years. It's more evocative of the old American Football League.
All right, Lee, so I played from 87 to 95, and, you know, you're talking about going back 20, 25, 30 years. How have players, this is a general question, but how have players changed, or have they really over the years? Because, you know, you get to be our age, and it's like, oh, kids these days. I'm just curious, like, is the typical football player pretty much like they always were, or how are they different?
You know, there's a great quote by, like, Socrates a couple thousand years ago where he says the youth of today, you know, is unfocused, they're listless, they don't have a sense of responsibility. But they have changed because of the way in which they're raised. So you now have a generation of youth that is raised on social media, big screen computers with sound and color coming off of it, multitasking, and it attenuates or shortens attention span. So you better get it out quickly to this generation, because the focus is not quite there generationally, but you still have very dedicated players who understand the price, the work ethic that it takes to make it, but they play more video games. They are on every platform from Snapchat to Instagram to Facebook, and I think it has a subversive effect on attention span.
Lee, I'm just curious. Russell Wilson and the Seahawks will have a negotiation this summer, and there's talk that he'll be making $35 million a year. Once all is said and done, what year do you think it'll be when we're talking about a $50 million quarterback?
Well, it's coming, because what you've seen now is that the football quarterbacks are finally rivaling the highest paid players in other sports. It's a quarterback-centric game, and you can't win in contemporary football without a franchise quarterback. So let's define that as someone that you can build around for 10 to 12 years, that you win because of rather than with, and most importantly, someone who in adversity, they've thrown a couple interceptions, the crowd is booing, the center's looking at the quarterback like he's on hallucinogens, and the games getting out of hand, can that quarterback elevate, compartmentalize, adopt a quiet mind, and elevate his level of play to take a team to and through the Super Bowl? If you have a quarterback like that, it's really important to lock him up, you know, for a long time. If you really think about all the negotiations, you can remember there's rarely ever been a tempestuous quarterback negotiation. They want to sign him long term. The money in the league from television is going up. The gate is rising. The off the field revenue opportunities are flourishing, and football now dominates American culture because if you look back every week, NFL nighttime football is rated over every other form of entertainment. So as the money keeps going and the position keeps becoming more and more critical in a quarterback-centric league, you know, it won't take too long. You have Wentz and Goff will be up this year. In a year, Patrick Mahomes will be ready for an extension. So I think you'll just see it soar and soar. The irony, of course, is that it sort of eliminates the middle class in football because if you're paying players at that rate at critical positions, you then have to have players at the minimum making up the majority of the roster.
He is Lee Steinberg. Lee, congratulations. We're excited to see what your client Paxton Lynch does here in Seattle, and we're really grateful for you spending the time with us this afternoon.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Little bit of interesting trivia about how Paxton Lynch wound up in Denver. He was chosen with the 26th overall pick of the first round. It was actually the pick that belonged to the Seattle Seahawks originally. The Seahawks traded back five spots. They traded back with Denver, who was coming off a Super Bowl victory. They used the 31st pick, which Seattle got, to take Jermaine Ifedi. And they got the third round pick that was used to select Nick Vinette. And now, 2 years later, they get the player that Denver used. So essentially, they got three for the same price they would have paid for Paxton Lynch.
Got all of them.
Yeah, get everyone of them.
Take all of them.
Although, I don't know how many of them have appreciated. Jermaine Ifedi looks like he might have turned the corner this year, right?
I think so. I mean, those first two games were rough for him. And then, yeah, I thought it. He took, and it's a great lesson of how players develop, and especially if a quarterback who doesn't get the reps, you know, and that somebody was saying, well, you know, he's not going to be on the field and, you know, he's never going to get on the field because of Russell Wilson. But yeah, you learn, you sit there and learn, and then you do scout team and stuff like that. And you get a chance to sort of realize what it's like to be a pro. And I think that's a part of it. But everybody's on a different journey. Everybody's on a different path. And same thing with Jermaine Ifedi. All of a sudden, he turned the corner.
It's Danny, Dave, and Moore coming up next. Edgar Martinez picking up votes and picking up steam in Hall of Fame consideration. That's coming up next.
From the Alaska Airlines Studio,
it's Danny, Dave, and Moore, streaming everywhere at 710sports.com and the 710 Seattle app.
We're less than a week away from the Hall of Fame announcements, and everything is trending toward Edgar Martinez getting into the Hall of Fame. He needs 75% of the votes. Right now, we have a little less than half that have been publicly disclosed. He is on 168 of 185 of the ballots. That's 90%. He's on 90% of the ballots. You still have 227 that are left out there. And he's at a situation where, look, he doesn't even need to get most of them at this point. If he ends up with 141 of 227 that are left out there, which is 62%, he only needs 62% of the remaining ballots. And so far, here's the best indication, which is that Edgar is on 18 ballots that he was not included on a year ago. So that means that he's picked up 18 votes so far from guys whose ballots we knew from 2017. They've added his name to their ballot in 2018. He's only lost one vote. So everything looks very, very positive. I think the story of Edgar's induction and his election into the Hall of Fame is fascinating because it basically represents a change in the way we measure hitters' productivity, and that he didn't have any of the benchmarks that were typically associated with the Hall of Fame, but what we use to evaluate hitters, we became better at it in the time since he retired. We became better at it, specifically over the past 3 years and looking at what he did. So his career has been done and gone. 15 years since he's played. And in the last 3 years, there's been a better national appreciation of what he was able to do as a hitter, which I find fascinating.
Yeah, that is interesting. I think also the fact that you get from like guys like Mariano Rivera talking about how he was the hardest out of anybody that he ever pitched against. How long is the window?
10 years.
10 years.
That's still weird to me. That's still weird to me that you can't, and this is the last year for him, right?
It's the last year he's on this ballot. So, he would then go in front of a veterans committee years from now, which is how most recently Lee Smith and Harold Baines got in. But this is the last time he'll be in front of the baseball writers.
Yeah, I mean, a 312 average. It's also very impressive to me that he didn't play in the field, just because I think being a DH, not playing out in the field. You remember Nelson Cruz wanted to play out in right field, but he just wasn't fast enough. But he felt like it would help him hit better. It didn't turn out to be true last year. He still hit really well just being a DH. But that part impresses me, but... You think your guys sense that he's going to get in?
Yeah,
I feel like there's been enough national talk about it that it's going to be done this year.
Yeah, he was at 70% last year, just shy of the 75% he needed, and it certainly looks that way. We'll find out MLB Network 3 o'clock on Tuesday. And Danny, you mentioned Harold Baines. That's one of those guys that got in, and you're going, well, okay, if Harold Baines made it in, then certainly Edgar will make it in too. Because Edgar was better playing in 800 fewer games. You look at all the stats. If you compare Harold Baines with Edgar Martinez, there's not really even a good comparison. So, and they're finally loosening up on this whole business about him being a DH. And it's pretty easy when you look at it. I don't think it's just a Seattle perspective anymore. I think it used to be like you're pulling for the Mariner, the hometown guy. But now I think all the baseball guys across the country are realizing when they look at these numbers. Some of these numbers I saw from a USA Today article over the weekend where it's just, it compares favorably on-base percentage to Stan Musial, okay? And then on-base plus slugging percentage with Frank Robinson. Slugging percentage, same as Willie McCovey. You see names like that, and Edgar Martinez, you know that he belongs in the Hall of Fame.
And that's the thing is that it used to be, did you have 3,000 hits? Did you have 300 wins? Did you hit 500 home runs? It was these straight benchmark numbers. And we've become better about measuring it. I want to just from 2010 through 2015. So that's the first 6 years that Edgar was eligible on the ballot, that he was able to be voted for. His percentage on the ballots ranged from 36, that was the highest it was, down to 25%. So he basically was on between a fourth and a third of the ballots. And then this is what's happened in the past 3 years. 2016, he's on 43.4%. 2017, he's on 58.6%. Last year, he's on 70.4%. Now, some of that is the urgency that builds up because you know that he's getting toward the end of that window. Some of it is also just a change in the voting patterns. Hall of Fame voting remains one of the weirdest things for me. And especially because you look at some of the other guys, he's on track. The guys that right now are above that 75% threshold that would allow them to get in, Mariano Rivera, who's been named on all of the ballots so far, and in fact could be the first unanimous election. Mike Mussina, and then you've got Roy Halladay. Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds, they're both right there at about the same spot, 73% so far. I would guess that they're going to go down once all of the, because what we know now are the guys that have publicly proclaimed it. They've been willing to open up their ballot and share who they're voting for. So we'll get next Tuesday, we'll get the avalanche of votes that will be there. I don't know how you have a Hall of Fame without having Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens in it. Like those were two of the five most dominant players of that generation.
Well, I'm starting to agree with you. You know, there for a while I was thinking, man, those guys cheated. You can't let them in. But there's already guys who are cheaters who are in there, and you don't know who they are exactly. So I think they should just open it up
to
everybody.
Who are they?
I don't know.
Oh, well, then they're not.
Well, I know that there are cheaters in there.
How do you know? You just said you knew. Now you say you don't know.
Well, I just have a sneaking suspicion that there are several in there that shouldn't be in there. But I can't prove it.
Because they what?
There's nothing I can prove.
They took steroids?
I believe that they did.
Okay.
Yeah. But I'm not so sure about that, though.
But we know Clemens and Bonds did. Like, that's...
Yeah,
no, well, do you agree, though, Danny, there's guys in there?
Yes. I think that...
Okay, well, how do you know?
Well, because based on the fact that the tests were not as nuanced before, and there was an entire generation and period where you couldn't test for it.
Yeah.
So it is based on suspicion.
That's a better answer than I gave you. Yeah.
Well, then we could get into the debate of who's ahead, because brought this up before. Do you think the testers are ahead or the testees are ahead? That didn't sound right.
Yeah.
Testees.
No, you had two E's on that,
yeah.
though.
Yeah.
Here would be the thing. If we use a different criteria with Edgar to go back and look at his career hasn't changed. His career has remained the same, that same body of work over the 10 years of his eligibility, but it's evaluated differently now.
Yeah. So why are these guys changing their votes? You think it has more to do with, oh, it's the last year for Edgar, we got to get him in, or that they've looked at it? I mean, which do you think is more?
I think it's more. I think there's a natural pull when a guy's toward the end of his inclusion to do it, but the most of it is people now using OPS, slugging percentage, and on-base percentage, and weighing those factors more than they did aggregate total of hits. It's a way that we've changed the way we've judged it. Is it fair to then change the way you judge someone else's numbers based on what you learn about what they did afterward? My opinion has always been that the Hall of Fame is as much a museum as it is an honor. And you can't not acknowledge games that happened and were important in the history of the game and pretend that Roger Clemens didn't pitch and pretend that Barry Bonds didn't hit, because there's such a huge... And do whatever you want. Bill Simmons has suggested building a wing in the shape of a needle, or perhaps putting a little needle on their plaque to indicate that they were under the suspicion of performance. And I don't care what you do, or like, hey, this guy was kind of hinky, there are some questions about it. But you can't pretend that those things didn't happen, because they happened and we all watched it. And to not include it, well, I mean, Barry Bonds should be in there.
Well, I get that part of it. And yeah, maybe those two guys. But all the rest, with the speculation, isn't it a pass-fail? Did you ever take classes pass-fail?
Yeah, I took some over in
I wasn't WSU. Able to. I wish I would have.
Yeah, there was a, gosh, what was it? It was some kind of a history class that I didn't want. And I didn't like the guy who was my section leader. His name was Bondos Green, back when before people had slash names. And he didn't like football players. And so I took it pass-fail, and I did the minimal amount of work that you would do. And he put on my final grade pass, and then he put D+. And I'm like, it's not a grade. It's a pass-fail. You know, and so, you know, he just wanted to make his little commentary there. But I passed. I passed that class. The end. Okay?
I did too.
The end. There was no letter grade. There's no letter grade. I passed and I got the credit. So, and in my opinion, it was a stupid course. So, anyway, these guys are pass fail in this test, are they not?
So, is it if you never tested positive for steroids, you are eligible? You should be voted in on the merits of your career?
Of course.
Okay.
Because isn't that what the deal is? I mean, how can otherwise
no,
you just leave
up
it to...
It's left up to writers to be the conscience of the game, which, look, I mean, the idea of trusting media members to do this is admittedly somewhat, it's suspect. It's
questionable. Don't make fun of media members, because Jim will get mad.
Yeah, I do.
I think Jim lets me do it.
Don't slouch in your chair, but... Jim. Why don't you sit up first?
I'm not slouching. I still don't like Sean Payton.
Yeah.
No?
Matt
Patricia? No, I'm excited about this, though, aren't you? I mean, on Tuesday, we're going to find out.
Yeah.
We'll get another Edgar back at Cooperstown this summer. You know, the other thing, I just want to bring this up since we're talking about fellow writers. Larry Stone, I heard him on the Hot Stove League the other night with Aaron and Shannon and Mike Blowers, and he's writing a book about Edgar, and it's coming out this summer, and I think it's going to be a rousing success either way, but I think book sales would be helped by Edgar going into the Hall of Fame.
So you're hoping Edgar gets voted in to help Larry's book?
Yeah, that's part of it.
Sure, that's good.
But I mean, I want him in there anyway, because Edgar's such a good guy and he's deserving with his stats. But yeah, I'm pulling for a fellow writer to do well with his book.
I used to see Edgar working out in the early 2000s and at the gym that I went to. And I can just tell you, he worked really hard and he was very serious in the weight room.
So you guys just ran into each other at
the
Y? No,
I just passed him by. I mean, he didn't know who I was, and I knew who he was. And it was over at the Redmond Athletic Club, I think. And
is there like a pro athlete wing of that? You guys just working out among
no,
the
No, he was
boy.
Just like, you know, well, I wasn't playing at the time, so I was a regular citizen. But, you know, he was just doing stuff. I assume he's working out at the Mariner facility, but in his off time, he was working out there. That guy worked his tail off. That's why he was so strong.
Could we go to the gym sometime and I could just watch you like critique and comment on the other guys as they're benching, or maybe get down
we
and
should
throw
do
up
that.
Some serious weight?
I don't think...
Yeah.
I don't think I'm in a position right now. I'm a little out of training, Danny.
It'd still be fun. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm just not as strong as I used to be.
So you're plenty strong, Dave. We've got hockey terms. That's coming up next, and Snoop Dogg's going to help us. You'll hear how.
This is Danny, Dave, and Moore.
Live from the Alaska Airlines Studios at 710sports.com and the 710 Seattle Sports app.
I like this selection. One of the reasons I like it is because we've got to get up to speed on some hockey lingo.
We do.
Yeah. I think it's important for the overall, well, just for a lot of different things. And one of the people that I thought that we'd be able to recruit into this was Snoop Dogg. When I was looking around, I found it. How do you guys feel about how solid do you feel your hockey knowledge is?
Not very good, but let's get Snoop Dogg cracking.
Yeah, we'll get it go. Okay, the first one that we've got, the first one that's here. Well, here we go.
Get out your dictionaries, because today, the professor of pucks, Dog Cherry, a.k.a. the greater one, is teaching you hockey words at Hockey 101, the Hockey Slang Edition.
That's right. Our first term, apple. How it's going to work is you can text in to 710-710.
Apple's a hockey term.
Apple is a hockey term. What do you think an apple is, Dave?
Man, is it maybe when the goalie picks the puck out of the air?
Okay. Goalie picks the puck out of the air. Jim, what is your guess?
It's when the forward gets the puck in the crease.
Okay. You're using a little bit more hockey term, the crease being the goal.
I wanted to sound intelligent.
Because the crease is technically the area right in front of the goal in that little semicircle. And either which you guys would like to nominate, do you think you know what apple is? C-Rod or Jessamine?
Is it simply the puck? Ooh. Another word for puck?
That is an interesting suggestion. It is, however, wrong. Snoop Dogg, what is an apple?
An apple is an assist. Like your man Claude Giroux. He has mad apples.
Okay, now, here's one, though.
What'd he say?
He has mad apples.
So, an apple's an assist?
That's correct.
And in hockey, you can, on one goal, get two guys with assists, right?
Yes.
Okay.
The hockey assist is the pass that sets up the pass that sets up the goal.
Yeah.
So you can have mad apples
basketball,
on a single play.
Basketball, that doesn't happen.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Would you call that a double apple?
Double apple, yeah. You want to know an amazing stat about James Harden? So he's scored 57 points in his past two games, each of his past two. Not one of those baskets has been assisted. There's not been an assist. 57 points in two straight games, and he has not. None of the shots he's made have had an assist attached to
him. That means he's a ball hawk.
It means he's a pig.
I watched part of that game last night. Yeah, he was doing, step back stuff.
All right, this one's going to be a little easier. Biscuit. What do you think the biscuit is?
Puck.
Puck.
That is puck. Correct.
A biscuit is the puck. All these fool words. I'm getting hungry talking about all this hockey stuff. Somebody bring me something to eat, a Danish or something.
You put the biscuit between the pipes.
We're getting a little ahead of ourselves. We've got that one.
We have that one. Sorry.
We have that one coming up a little bit later.
Jim just shot his wad. He's done. That's all he knew.
How about celly? What do you think a celly is?
Celly. How do you spell it?
C-E-L-L-Y. It's a celly.
I have no idea.
Jim?
It's when you successfully fight off a power play.
Okay, let's see. Snoop Dogg, what is a celly?
A celly is a hockey celebration after a big goal. Look, he's ice dancing.
How about clapper? An absolute clapper.
Jess?
No idea.
Long range goal.
Ooh, very, very good guess, Jess. Not exactly right, but I think very, very, very close.
A clapper is a slap shot. Not the thing you use to turn the lights on and off. Oh, that's the slap shot. Slapper. Clapper. I call it a sliznapper. You know what I'm telling
me? The sliznapper that's there. How about five hole?
I didn't understand that last part.
Yeah.
Would that be in like the upper corner of the net?
Five hole. That is a hole. The upper corner of the net, but not the five hole. What do you think the five hole is? You would go five hole.
Five hole? Boy, it's a shot from the total distance of the ice.
A five hole. Why in the world would that be a five hole?
Well, I don't know. I don't know hockey stuff. I'm here for Snoop Dogg to help me.
The five hole is the space between the goalie's legs. Going five hole sounds dirty, but It just means scoring in the most humiliating way possible. In between the legs.
I thought that was...
That's by far my favorite description. It sounds dirty, but it isn't. It's just scoring in the most humiliating way possible.
Right between his legs.
Yeah. All right, Jim gave us this one before. Pipes. What do you think the pipes are?
Oh, they're the pipes that hold up the net.
That's correct.
Pipes are the goalposts. I'll use it in a sentence. That guy hit the pipe.
How about a muffin? What do you think a muffin is?
Another term for a guy who gets a hat trick.
Ooh, that's a good one. Totally wrong.
A muffin is a weak shot on net.
How about
weak shot on net?
A weak shot on net. He tossed up a muffin. How about a pizza?
Pizza. Is that when you spin around and score a goal?
Pizza is a bad pass up the middle that's easily stolen.
And the last one is stoned. What does it mean to get stoned?
Checked.
Checked is Dave's answer. Jim?
To be shut out.
To get high with Snoop Dogg.
When a goalie makes a great save. What did you think I meant?
Smoking weed?
It's Danny David Moore. We'll bring in the professor next.